You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Friday, September 2nd, 2011, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
Evan Bernstein.
Good evening, folks.
And we have a special guest rogue this week, Sarah Mayhew. Sarah, welcome to The Skeptic's Guide.
Thanks for having me.
Rebecca is unavailable during the recording of this show. She's just too busy for us this week.
Yeah, what's she doing anyway?
She's doing her panel right now.
I thought she was doing her nails or her hair or something.
No, she's doing her quiz show right now.
Yes, that's right.
We are recording this show while we are all together in Atlanta at DragonCon. This isn't our live show, but we are recording a session, an episode while we are here. But this show will go out on September 17th. So, Evan, tell us what is special about that day.
In 1822, at the French Academie Royale des Inscriptions, Jean-François Champollion read his famous paper describing his solution to the mystery of the triple inscriptions on the Rosetta Stone, which had been unearthed in July of 1799 by Napoleon's army near the Rosetta branch of the Nile, hence the name of the famous stone. Champollion's work to decipher the hieroglyphics had begun in 1808, and a gentleman by the name of Thomas Young had done some preliminary fragmentary work, but otherwise was Champollion's major accomplishment in his career.
So what was so special about the Rosetta Stone?
What's so special about the Rosetta Stone is that there are three scripts that appear on this fragment of stone. Three distinct scripts. The upper text is ancient Egyptian hieroglyphs. The middle portion is the Demotic script, which is like the Egyptian common language that was used at the time.
The commoners used that language.
And when I say at the time, we're talking 196 BC. It's when the stone was dated to. And the lowest section of the stone is in ancient Greek. And because it presents essentially the same text in all three scripts, it provided the key to the modern understanding of Egyptian hieroglyphs.
Right, so essentially we knew what the hieroglyphs were standing for because there was another language that we already understood. So reading a little bit further, it sounds like that the Greek was the starting point, and that's what was known. The Demotic script was barely known. They certainly didn't have a full description of it, and again, the hieroglyphic text was also known of, but not deciphered. So this was the ancient Greek was the hook. That was the one that we knew that was able to decipher the other two.
And it took him what, better part of 15 years to
it must have been quite a puzzle.
Puzzle together. So that's quite an accomplishment.
So I always think of now this little pedantic point. Last time we talked about Egyptian hieroglyphics was the term that I used, and then someone wrote in to say that it's either hieroglyphic writing or hieroglyphs. But not hieroglyphics. But then I wrote back and saying, yeah, but come on, everyone knows exactly what I'm talking about when I said that, right? That's a distinction without a difference. And he actually, to his credit, wrote back and said, you know, after I wrote that pedantic response, I was in a lecture with like a world expert, you know, in the writing
and
used the term hieroglyphics.
Of course.
So if
he stood up and he punched the guy out.
Right. So I mean, I think it's hieroglyphics versus hieroglyphic writing, we tend to shorten, you know, phrases or words, and if it doesn't lose any precision or meaning, who cares?
Right. Tinfoil, aluminum foil.
Unfortunately, lots of people care. See in our emails.
Enough people care.
Well, at the very least, though, it is very interesting to hear someone that knows what the correct way to talk about it is, and that correction, it was interesting. You know, when Steve just said it, I had never heard that, didn't know the distinction, and I find that very interesting.
And it's also a testament to the evolution of language. It's not static. It's an evolving thing. It changes over time. There's no stopping it. You really shouldn't try to stop it and just accept, you know, just like I've learned to accept a whole nother, you just gotta deal with it. You know, it's people are saying it for a reason. It flows. It sounds better. And whatever reason doesn't matter. If it's in use, it's part of the language.
Right.
You know, once it reaches a certain critical threshold.
I would go beyond accepting it. I would encourage it. I think there's something counterproductive to having a language sort of calcified, you know, in place without changing. I mean, you always think of like William Shakespeare went out of his way to make up new words and new ways of saying things. Right? There's a certain power to that.
Yeah, absolutely. I totally agree. But sometimes you hear something and you're like, it just grates on your nerves. Like, I don't know I don't like that. I hope it doesn't take.
Well, the conflict is convention. It's important to have a certain amount of convention so that we can talk to each other and understand each other, right? If there was no convention, then obviously that would make it very difficult to have precise and exact right. communication. But there's got to be, in my opinion, accepted conventions. Some things have to be the correct way of saying things or writing things. But there's got to be flexibility around the edges. And again, I think the core criterion for, you know, what kind of convention matters is it actually necessary to make your communication unambiguous and precise? Mm-hmm. If it is, then keep it. If it's not, if it really makes no difference, and like if everyone in the world knows what I mean when I say hieroglyphics, then that's not something worth fighting over.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
Good. I've convinced you all of my opinion.
We all agree.
Well, when it comes to using idioms correctly, I could care less.
That one bothers me.
What are you calling an idiom?
Because it doesn't make any sense.
Right.
It just doesn't make any sense to say I could care less. Okay, so that means you don't care that much.
You have no idea how much you care.
Yeah. I could care less. So I care. So much so that there's room below how much I care. There's the possibility for me caring less.
It should be I couldn't care less.
Yes, it is I couldn't care less. Yeah. That's the point. I couldn't care less. Right. That's the phrase. But that's one where people shorten it to I could care less, but actually reverse the meaning and it doesn't make any sense anymore.
Yeah, but everyone knows what they're talking about, Steve. So I know. You should be okay with it.
Yeah, Steve. It's the most unique thing we've talked about on the show in a long time.
Irregardless of what Steve said. I think people add the error there because they think it sounds more intelligent.
Irregardless. All right, moving on. Bob, tell us about the Chinese plan to capture an asteroid into Earth orbit. This just doesn't sound good.
This really got my attention. Their idea is to take an asteroid and bring it into orbit around the Earth for study and eventually use it for resources like precious metals. And I've thought of that many, many times, not necessarily bringing it to us, but traveling to an asteroid and thinking, yeah, here's a trillion metric tons of palladium or whatever. Yeah, that would be, imagine finding a mountain of gold or a mountain of some precious metal that you can then bring back down to Earth. That would be amazing. But actually bringing the asteroid itself to Earth, to me, left my mouth open because I can't imagine any other country allowing any other country to bring an asteroid that close to Earth. Because obviously, if you make a mistake, whoops, you know, I just leveled Kansas or all of North America, depending on how big the asteroid was. So yeah, I think it struck me as insane that they would even consider it because I don't think anyone would let them bring it. I mean, how do you practice that? You know,
they want to park it in orbit?
Well, then of course you read the details and it's not quite as insane as I thought. I'm just talking about my first impression here, but these are researchers at Tsinghua University in Beijing, China, and they've been studying NEOs, near Earth objects, and they seriously want to bring one near to Earth, but not as near as I thought. You know, you think it's, you know, it would be within the orbit, within the moon, and that's really not the plan. But what they did was they were looking at asteroids that occasionally would be captured by Jupiter. And then it would orbit Jupiter for a while, and then it would kind of get ejected after a certain amount of time. And that kind of gave them the idea that maybe they could use that type of thing to their advantage. And they actually found an example, a comet, Oterma, in 1936 that did that exact same thing. It actually apparently went briefly to orbit around Jupiter and then kind of got ejected after a while. So they went looking in the sky, looking into nearby space for these NEOs, these near Earth objects, to see if there was one that would have the same thing would happen. They didn't find any, but
they meaning it would go into orbit around the Earth for a while,
right?
And then,
spontaneously
and
going, right. So they looked for that, didn't find it, not too much of a surprise, but they did find a couple that were really, really close. And one of them that they found seemed to be a perfect candidate. It was the velocity would only need to be adjusted by about 410 meters per second, which really isn't that much. And it was 10 meters across.
Ten meters.
I mean, when I think of an asteroid, I'm not thinking 10 meters. I'm thinking thousands of feet. I mean, at the very least.
Well, where's the cutoff between an asteroid and a meteoroid?
Right. So we got to call it something else. Microoid or something, right?
Well, the 10 meters, to me, that's a meteoroid. That's a, right. That would become a meteorite if it landed on Earth. I don't know if it's just terminology, or maybe I'm just not up on the latest.
So they're not going to bring in a planet killer into near Earth orbit,
which
screaming
makes sense.
In and have it precisely right. Just land in orbit around the Earth. That seems
right.
A little dangerous.
But actually, if it's 10 meters, of course it depends on what it's made of. But if this is only 10 meters across, it would burn up in the atmosphere. So the risk is essentially nil. So if you could do that, you could test the technology for bringing it in. You could study it, and then you could 10 meters. I mean, still, I don't know what they might find in it. But so I think it's much less dangerous than I originally thought, considering it's so small.
Bob, you said that, what are we going to learn from a 10-meter asteroid being brought into orbit? So what are we doing? We're just testing the technology to see if it's feasible and can work? Is that essentially what they're doing? I mean,
well,
it's just a test of a concept?
So, I mean, getting it over here, they really don't go into too much detail about how they would actually change its orbit. They didn't go into that kind of detail. They did mention that just studying it could be helpful. I mean, you're looking at an object that might not have been changed for billions of years. You could learn about the early solar system if you study these types of things. So yeah, and who knows what other surprises it might bring. Perhaps it could be a piece of Mars with some weird fossils on it. Who knows? You never know what you're going to discover. So I think we could learn some interesting stuff by it. And then mining it. I mean, even if it was precious, you got a rock 10 meters big made of something really precious, some weird precious metal, and hey, that's great. I mean, make some money out of it, but.
I think they turn a profit off of something?
Like not that? If it's iron, not if you're going to pay
not
a nickel.
Yeah.
But,
depending on what it is.
What would it have to be made of in order for it to be cost effective to mine it in such a high orbit?
Wait, I wrote that down.
Hamburgers.
No, I have no idea.
Unobtainium.
Unobtainium. That would do it.
Who knows?
Well, wait. I mean, any of the precious metals, I'm sure.
I don't know. Even gold. That's how you. So what? All you're going to do is drop the price of gold.
Right.
And the goal initially is not. It's not to bring it in there and mine it. The goal initially, and they stress it, is to study it. It's to learn from it. And eventually, they could think about maybe, hey, let's see what we can get out of this thing, or maybe. Use it as a springboard to bring something a little bit bigger, maybe not into orbit around the Earth, but maybe into a Lagrange point to orbit, or to a really wide orbit with a much less margin for error. So if they make a decent sized mistake, it's not going to hit Earth or to orbit around the moon. Who knows? But it would be pretty cool to bring a mountain of some precious metal close to Earth that you can then mine and
how about manufacturing in outer space for things like the space station, and maybe they could use it for on the moon they have rocks that have hydrogen and oxygen in them, and they can use them for fuel.
That's true, because any metal that's in orbit you don't need to bring out of Earth's gravity well, and you could save many, many millions of dollars.
Yeah, I just don't see how it would be cost effective anytime soon. To be mining asteroids.
Right.
It would be cool to see a space Klondike rush, though.
Ah,
yeah, right.
There's gold in them there, asteroids.
Yeah, there's a prize. There's your X prize. Here's $5 trillion worth of material. Let's see who can get at it.
Well, most of the metal-bearing asteroids, right, are iron and nickel. So I wonder what percentage of them have more of the rare elements in them.
I don't know.
Well, I want to talk about another acupuncture study. I know I talk about this every now and then, but this one has a couple of new elements to it that I think are worth talking about.
You're going to make a couple
about.
New points on acupuncture, Steve?
Yeah, right.
Oh, nice.
So we often will see studies reported in the mainstream media saying, that acupuncture works, but then when you look closer at the data, you see that it actually shows that it was either just a terribly done study, not well controlled. And sometimes the study was well controlled, and it actually shows that acupuncture doesn't work, or it's not even a study of quote unquote acupuncture. They're doing electroacupuncture, which was really just a study of electrical stimulation, not acupuncture. The other kind of studies that I've been seeing quite a bit of are ones that say a study that shows how acupuncture works. Which, of course, I don't think that the evidence shows that acupuncture works, so that's always interesting. They at best are showing a putative mechanism by which something like acupuncture might work. There was such a study recently that was actually even far worse than that in terms of overstating the results. So listen to what these researchers did. They took what they're calling an acupuncture needle. And this, of course, raises the question, well, what's the difference between an acupuncture needle and a regular needle? Okay, maybe there's a certain size range that you would consider an acupuncture needle, but there's nothing special about an acupuncture needle. It's a needle. You're sticking a needle into.
Is it a hollow needle? Like a needle?
No, it's not.
Contains morphine, right? Yeah. For the pain.
Right. Already by calling it an acupuncture needle, they're introducing a concept that doesn't really fit, you know.
Are you saying that's a red flag we should be concerned
about?
Yeah,
so it leads to the question, what makes a needle an acupuncture needle? And how are you testing acupuncture by simply using a needle? There are other components that make acupuncture. The acupuncture points need to be involved, right? Mm-hmm. And if you discard that concept, then what are you really studying? But anyway, let's get to the details of this study are interesting. So what they did was they took a needle and then they stuck it into tissue, both in vitro and in vivo. And then they used a little piezoelectric device, you know, one that converts electricity into mechanical force. And they used that to vibrate the needle. Right. And they vibrated the needle at fairly high frequencies, up to 50 hertz in the study.
50 cycles per second.
Yeah, hertz being a cycle per second. So what they found was that at the higher frequencies, that they could detect vibrational waves, what they're calling acoustic waves.
Mm.
Acoustic shear waves was the precise term they used. They were detecting these acoustic shear waves in the surrounding tissue, up to a certain distance from the needle. So that much is not surprising. You're essentially vibrating the needle, and then you're measuring vibrational responses to that vibration. You know, so that's seems an obvious conclusion. But they also found that the tissue that was being vibrated was releasing calcium, and that calcium then is a signal for cells to do other things. And they speculated that maybe the calcium release induced by the acoustic shear waves was causing the release of endorphins, which is a natural painkiller, and that's the quote-unquote mechanism for acupuncture.
So if that's true, then you should be able to do that test with any needle or some other device and achieve the same results.
Well, yeah, so it seems to be the vibrational energy going through the tissue that's doing it. They didn't establish that the needle was important, right? Which, again, why calling it an acupuncture needle is sort of rigging the conclusion of the study. But it's worse than that. So, interestingly, they're claiming that they've discovered how acupuncture works. Really, they should have said a potential mechanism for acupuncture. Right. But really, they should have said that they've proven that their mechanism is not the way that acupuncture can possibly work. Because what they found was that at 40 hertz, 40 cycles per second, that there was this, you know, significant release of calcium, which is the mechanism that they're pointing to. At 20 hertz, there was a slight release of calcium. At 10 and 5 hertz, there was none at all. There was zero response. So the mechanism that they discovered only becomes measurable at 20 hertz and is really only significant above that. It was clearly, you know, fully in effect at 40 hertz. And here's the crux of their study. They make a connection between their method of vibrating the needle to what an acupuncturist does when he sticks the needle through the skin.
Wait, when you say their method of vibrating it, the way that they do it with their fingers?
No. The experimental method of vibrating the needle in this study was to use a piezoelectric device, a device that converts electricity into mechanical force, in order to vibrate the needle at up to 50 hertz, right? They said, this is a representation, right? Will represent the acupuncturist with their hands sticking a needle into a patient and then rapidly either twisting the needle or moving it up and down.
20 hertz?
Right, but that's the thing.
It's ridiculous.
They don't really discuss, and this is a massive oversight on the part of the authors, whether or not their model is a good model for what the acupuncturist does. And they completely ignore the fact that at 10 hertz, and I defy anyone listening to this to really, I mean, maybe somebody can barely get up to that, but to like try to vibrate your fingers back and forth at 10 times a second, it's really, mm-hmm. I mean, just try to do it. Maybe if you're really good, you can get up to 6, you know, 5, 6, 7 hertz, 10, is
let
hard.
Let alone 20
Let alone 20. 20 is when the effects started to become noticeable. So, yeah, so if you think this is a good model for the acupuncture, then vibrate that needle at 20 hertz with your fingers. And then we can take the results seriously. Otherwise, they've actually proven that this can't be the way that acupuncture works, because no human being can vibrate a needle at 20 hertz. That's not what acupuncturists do. But isn't it amazing that they concluded that this is like, for the first time, we discover how acupuncture works, and then the news media, like major media outlets, dutifully report the headline, "New study shows how acupuncture works," without really delving into any of this.
Yeah, but aren't they all Zen masters? Like, maybe they could do some fancy, like, karate chop on
the... Yeah, I mean, you say that jokingly, but they, you know, often you'll get this sort of hand-waving explanations like, well, you know, the Western scientists don't know how to study acupuncture, you know.
And special
okay, food. Yeah, show me again, to grab that needle, vibrate it at 20 hertz, and I'll be impressed. I didn't, you know, when I wrote about this, I did note that the research is coming out of Hong Kong, and this is relevant because there was a study published in 1998, I believe, that just reviewed the acupuncture literature. They found that, up to that time, guess what percentage of acupuncture studies coming out of Hong Kong and like China and, you know, other Asian countries where acupuncture is believed in? Guess what percentage of those studies were positive?
100%.
100%. Close to, yeah. 100% of studies were positive.
Must be something to it.
You just don't see something that in the scientific literature, right? I mean, that's just crazy.
Right.
Meanwhile, studies coming out of Europe and the United States and you know, showed much lower rates of being positive. And in fact, for most things, they're negative. They're the bottom line result of reviewing the evidence is in fact negative. Right. It's N-rays. Exactly.
Yeah.
you have to have the cultural belief in it in order for it to be positive. And then it's positive 100% of the time, which really means, if you're really being honest, what that means is that the research is worthless, which means it's so overwhelmed with researcher and or publication bias that you can't trust it at all.
It's even questionable whether or not it's deliberate. Deliberately fake.
Well, I mean, you can't read minds, right? And we end, did the French researchers deliberately fake N-rays, you know, what was that, 100 years ago about when that happened, early 20th century? Or was it just that it was expectation bias, researcher bias? Maybe there was a little bit of pride in French science. They wanted to get one up on whatever their competitors. It doesn't make it deliberate. They probably really believed what they were doing was correct. They just were not controlling for their individual bias. Here, the researchers make their bias totally known in the way they write up this study. I mean, they completely, 180 degrees, misinterpreted the results, the significance of their results.
Yeah.
Maybe not the literal results themselves. They measured what they measured. The other thing about this study, which I just frankly find unbelievable, is that when they did the study in people, they found that the acoustic shear waves conducted differently at acupuncture points than at non-acupuncture points.
Oh, come on.
Now, yeah, right.
Meridian,
oh, come on, exactly.
You mean meridian points?
The literal acupuncture points, the points
the
along
body.
The meridians, whatever, that the special points that they, in this study, they say these are quote-unquote anatomically invisible, which means they're the equivalent of Carl Sagan's invisible floating heatless dragon.
It's magic.
Right? They're invisible to evidence, to science, which means they don't exist.
Wow.
I mean, the literature's been reviewed, and the bottom line is there's no evidence for the existence of acupuncture points. They don't exist. Yet these researchers are finding different results at acupuncture points versus non-acupuncture points, which is a frankly unbelievable result. There's no indication that they were really properly blinding themselves. So again, it's N-rays all over again. And the fact that it's coming out of a part of the world that is known from prior, you know, reviews of the research to display this incredible bias. You take all of that together, and this is basically a worthless study at the end of the day.
And things like acupuncture are covered by medical insurance here in
variably.
The United States.
It's variable.
But in some cases it is.
In some cases it is, and that seems to be the trend because I think a lot of this misreporting of these studies.
Doesn't it just boil you, though, that, okay, so this very poor study comes out, the media jumps on it, you know, they love publishing this type of thing because, you know, it's the type of thing that they think their audience wants to hear. What about all the studies that show it doesn't work? And why isn't that having an effect on our society and on the insurance companies and on what people think? Forget it just goes unheard.
You forget the misses, you remember the hits. It's sexier.
Yeah, because the proponents aren't honest brokers of scientific information. They have an agenda and a bias. And, I mean, I do think there's sometimes when, you know, you point it out, it has some effect. It's just the effect is being overwhelmed right now by a pretty persistent campaign to promote acupuncture and a general atmosphere of gullibility and of, I think, motivated from political correctness, sort of allowing the standards, the usual standards of science and evidence to be watered down.
Sorry, have you ever had acupuncture?
No.
Ever?
No.
Did you ever consider it?
Well, I can tell you if someone has the ability to vibrate their hands at over 10 hertz, they're wasting their talent in acupuncture. Just saying.
You know, we are in the same room together. We could do live demonstrations.
Oh, boy.
You know, I agree with what Sarah is saying, though. It's like, you know, you look at, like, the reality of it. It's so stupid for them to, like, make this claim that they're vibrating their hands at 10 hertz. Like, and what about all the other – then it kind of opens the door of, like, what are their superhero powers of, like, these people that practice these things
that
we don't
know
about?
But they really glossed over that. They just their real major malfunction was in saying that their – model, their experimental model was a good representation of what an acupuncturist does when it isn't. It's a crappy model. And if you're going to use it as a model, you know, I think an unbiased, reasonable researcher would say, there's no effect at 10 hertz and below. And it only comes in when we do 20 hertz. Well, I guess that rules this out as a mechanism. You know, that's pretty much it for this idea. Yeah. Because no one is vibrating the needle at 20 hertz. But that thought never entered their mind.
Right.
You know, at least there's no indication of it on paper that it did. And it's like it was probably the invisible elephant in the room. Did I mix my metaphors there? It was the elephant in the room.
Right.
Where they were, you know, it was like no one probably wanted to mention the fact that, yeah, but doesn't it, it's only kicking in at 20 hertz. What does that mean for our model of, you know, moving the needle, but it was all, you know, no, but this has to be pro-acupuncture. We can't say anything negative about acupuncture. Right.
Well, I don't know, Steve. Those Asian kids, man, they're really talented. They can do some wacky shit. I mean, I saw a guy, like, juggle heads once, connected to people. So the bottom line, once again, the ball gets moved forward for pseudoscience when the study shows that the ball should be moving backwards for pseudoscience.
Basically, yeah.
Another thing I thought of, I mean, I've seen acupuncture needles inserted many times, and sometimes they shake them, but sometimes they don't.
They don't.
So they don't. It's not even a consistent thing. I don't think. I mean,
The clinical data shows it doesn't matter. Again, poking the skin with toothpicks is as effective as inserting the needle at the right place and to the right depth and eliciting the dikhi, you know, where you feel something you're supposed to feel and you twist it or move it at that point. You do all the things you're supposed to do, all the things you're trained to do, and it doesn't matter a bit. You could randomly poke their skin with toothpicks and get the exact same effects.
What does the dikhi have to do with this?
Dikhi.
Oh.
That's the
sensation the acupuncturist get when he hits the magical spot.
Sensation?
Yeah. Right? Yes.
Oh, okay.
the magic.
Is that the G-spot for the acupuncturist?
He's eating the magical non-atomical spot.
Yeah. it feels like cool water all over my body. Remember that commercial?
Yeah. Well, before we go on to who's that noisy, Sarah, we wanted to talk to you a little bit about yourself, just to introduce you more to our audience and about your work. So how'd you get involved with the skeptical movement, and what is it, what do you see as your role in it? What do you do?
Well, I'm a writer and illustrator. I specialize in producing manga graphic novels, which is...
Now, is it manga or manga?
I don't speak Japanese, so I can't judge pronunciation.
So we could say it however we want.
Yeah. Totally.
And then that's okay with you. Mango, whatever.
Yeah. Mango.
Yeah, manga.
Okay. Black Mamba. Yeah.
Yeah. So most people are familiar with anime, which is its animated counterpart. Manga is basically, you know, the Japanese word for comic book, pretty much.
But isn't? Didn't you tell me it's in black and white as well?
Yeah, usually. I mean, that's just because it's cheaper to print in black and white. So.
Nothing artistic or cultural based.
That's
about
the convention, but it's not a necessary component.
It's not necessary, no. But yeah, it's become industry standard. I'm sure there's lots of manga fans who they think that's, you know, that's a cool thing about it. It makes it different, you know. Reads right to left, like the Japanese books read, as opposed to the Western left to right.
So you literally would open your book up from the back.
Yeah.
And we would consider the back and go all the way from the...
Yeah.
That's how Hebrew works, too.
Yeah, exactly. So...
Why do Hebrew and Japanese go the same way? What's the connection there?
It's gotta be.
Is it homologous or analogous?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
That's the question.
Yes. All right. Is the answer.
It is one of those two.
When you create your comic, you're actually expecting people to read it backwards? I'm sorry, did I hear you correctly?
Yeah, well, actually, my first book, my first self-published book, Secrets of Sorcerers, I actually did it left to right. So it reads the normal way. But for my new series, Legend of the Star, I thought I'd go industry standard. So that...
Just to be crazy.
Just...
Where'd you learn this?
Well, I got interested in manga, probably when I was in high school, in manga and anime. And the English translators actually started... They used to flip the artwork so that it would read the quote-unquote normal way. Hmm. But when you flip the artwork, you're flipping the artwork, and that can cause unforeseen, you know, changes to what the original creator
right
intended.
Left
so,
right.
Yeah.
You know, like if you had any words written in there, like an exit sign or something, it wouldn't read correctly.
Yeah, or, you know, like I know one anime I followed, you know, the character has a scar on one side of his face. You know, or with samurai, right, they're always right-handed with their samurai swords. If you flip the artwork, then they're all left-handed, and so...
Some wacky parallel universe going
so,
on.
And it just changes the look of the artwork as well. So, I think, and I think also, again, like the novelty, I think a lot of fans just like that. Ooh, look, I'm reading something backwards. It's fun. Different.
So where's our connection to skepticism? How does skepticism fit into all this?
Well, actually, I sort of accidentally stumbled into skepticism. I might have actually gone the other way, possibly.
Other way meaning?
The woo road, I guess.
I like it, woo road.
Well, tell us the story. I really don't know anything about this.
So you're at a crossroads.
I suppose. I mean, in high school, I had a lot of friends who were good in the sciences. I was sort of the artsy person in our group. And there was this one friend we had who, he just seemed like a born scientist. Like, you'd ask him a question and he'd never give you a straight answer. You'd always, like, weigh the variables and they're like, well, if you consider this and that. And he went on to take post-secondary, like, theoretical physics and all this neat stuff. And it happened, if you remember a movie called What the Bleep Do We Know?
Oh, yeah.
It came
yes.
out years ago.
Oh, yeah.
Well, when it came out, me, the graphic design artsy student who has an interest in science, like as a hobby, saw that movie and didn't know any better. And was like, whoa, this blows my mind. Yeah. This was crazy.
The electrons in my hand are exchanging with the electrons in something else.
Yeah, and the water. You can change water with your thoughts, and we're made of water, and ooh,
Avatar.
It's all crazy. So I got all excited about this movie, met up with my friend who's taking theoretical physics, who would never give a straight answer. And I go, oh, I saw this movie, it's called What the Bleep Do We Know, and I got all excited to get into, like, science conversation with it, and he's like, it's bullshit. Like, straight out, like, the first time I've ever had a straight answer
was
from
that
this
a big
guy.
Bubble pop for you at that moment?
It was, it stuck with me. It was like Inception almost. Like, the seed had been planted that I was like, oh, like this movie, and there was advertisements on the Discovery Channel
Something
for
could
it.
Be bullshit?
Yeah,
the concept
it was,
that There's this whole movie that got you excited.
Yeah.
But a scientist you respected who gave you just a straight-up opinion said it was bullshit. And you had to reconcile that in your head.
Yeah, it was like hitting a wall. Like, oh my, things can be wrong? Like, people are telling me things that aren't true? And that just stuck to me for a few years until I happened to be in this business course for young entrepreneurs starting up businesses. And it just so happened that the coordinator was also a part-time Reiki master. Mm-hmm. So she kind of would like to inject her worldview into this business course. And they one day had a speaker come in who brought up the movie What the Bleep Do We Know?
And you said it's all bullshit.
And I was like, oh no, oh no. It's possible that everything this woman is saying is bullshit.
Yep.
And
it's very possible.
After that, after all those classes, when they're talking about, well, no, we don't believe in like newspaper horoscopes. We believe in real astrology.
That oh, works I through, love like, that. Yeah.
Electromagnetism and quantum entanglement.
Yeah.
I went straight home and I went. You know, I went on the
into
interwebs
and
I was like, I want to find out if they're wrong. Like, so, and that's how I, you know, I think I found Phil Plait's Bad Astronomy blog before he was with Discover and found this whole, like, there's this whole community of people who seem to know how to tell the difference. Like, I didn't know how to tell the difference.
Yeah, right.
I'm like, oh, this is awesome. I want to know. Like, I want to know if I'm wrong about something. So it was like, it was gold.
But then what happened? How did you actually make it to Tam and all that stuff?
Well, then she had to counter the Reiki with the manga. Right?
Oh. Yeah.
Yeah. I made it to Tam, actually, probably because I happened to make it to TED, which is a sort of prestigious conference.
How'd that happen?
In Long Beach. It was kind of a lot of luck. I just happened to have a friend that said, hey, Sarah, I know you're into like science and watching lectures. There's an awesome site that posts video speakers on a regular basis. So I checked it out and I just filling out their online form to be a member so you could, you know, add your favorite talks and everything. And they just happened to advertise like this brand new TED fellowship program, which was to help bring in individuals who might be an asset to the TED community, but who otherwise would not have the resources to attend. Cause it's really hard to get in to the TED event, even if you have the $6,000 membership fee to enter, it's still really hard to get into. So I just had nothing to lose, filled it out, and a couple months later got an email saying, we're inviting you to TED. And I was like, is this for realsies?
That's awesome.
Oh my gosh.
So you went to a conference and you saw a bunch of lectures?
Yeah, I went to TED in 2009. Did a short TED Fellows talk on the TED Fellows stage.
How intimidating was that?
It was okay. It was all right. I had it well planned out, and it wasn't a huge audience. It wasn't the main scary TED stage. It was a little TED Fellows stage. But yeah, it was a lot of fun. Met a lot of amazing people. I mean, there's just this magical thing about TED that it gave me a lot of sort of put a little bit of spotlight on my work. And so, yeah, that sort of eventually led to me being invited to TAM.
So now you're using your powers of manga for good rather than evil.
Exactly.
So how are you doing that?
My new series, Legend of the Star, is sort of a swords and sandals sci-fi epic type thing. And
swords and sandals?
Yeah. Yeah, like you know, like a He-Man type vibe but mixed with the sci-fi, you know. Mm-hmm. Like the Star Wars kind of vibe. You have, you know, knights and wizards and dark lords in outer space.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Sure.
Thing. Yeah.
Does
yeah.
anyone yell by the power of Grayskull or anything?
No, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. No.
It's by the power of White Skull.
I do have in my head, though, for any Hollywood bigwigs, I do have the gritty reboot to the Masters of the Universe blockbuster.
You have the script in your head?
In my head. It's awesome.
The reboot to the Masters of the Universe.
Yeah.
Huh?
Yeah.
Hmm. Yeah. It was a reboot?
Yeah. No, she's got the reboot in her head.
Oh, I see.
And she wrote it. She's lying there at night thinking about like how she wants a scantily clad He-Man.
But his new name, he wasn't scantily clad enough.
I liked He-Man.
Yeah.
Man-in-Arms. Remember all that?
Man-in-Arms.
She-Ra.
Yeah, She-Ra was pretty cool.
Mm-hmm. I like Cringer.
Cringer's awesome.
Wait. Was that the one with Snarf?
No. That's Thundercats.
Yeah, Thundercats.
What was that little wizard thing?
They are rebooting
some
Thundercats in cartoon form.
Orko, yeah.
The ghost. You
know, comic relief.
That was ridiculous. Why do they always have that?
That's the
Jar Jar Binks.
Or Tweaky.
Yeah.
From Buck Rogers.
At least Tweaky was funny.
That guy?
Tweaky was kind of funny, right?
Kind of, but I always thought Gary Coleman kind of in that role, which disturbed me. Gone.
I saw a freaking episode of Buck Rogers, the TV show, with Gary Coleman on it.
Yeah.
No way.
Yeah. And I forced myself to watch it on YouTube.
What you talking about, Buck?
Yeah, and it was bad. It was beyond bad, actually.
Really?
Yeah, like the production value of that TV show was really bad. And they like bring Gary Coleman on. They slap a silver shiny jumpsuit on him. And he's like, and it was like, what the hell is he doing on this TV show?
You're saying that was a poor bit of casting?
It was like, yeah, like, you know that was like, the typical crappy decision made in somebody's office. So we'll get, who's hot now? Who's good right now? Gary Coleman, bring that kid in here. Let's get him out here. Oh, he's not a kid. Doesn't matter. Bring him in here. Dress him up as a kid anyway. In a jumpsuit. Give him the silver jumpsuit. That's what they did. It was ridiculous.
So Legend of the Star, huh?
Right. Exactly.
So how was that a skeptical storyline? Tell us about it.
Not that
I'm not fascinated with Gary Coleman in a silver jumpsuit, but go ahead.
Well, my goal with Legend of the Star is what I'd like to see more in entertainment in general is more characters who are critical thinkers, who are science-based, who get out of a problem because, they're skeptical or they know how to be wrong. They're not right all the time. Who think their way out of a problem rather than, blow up their way out of a problem.
Or just have faith and it'll all work
just
out right.
Just believe.
Yeah.
Just believe.
Yeah, we don't bully reality into conforming to our beliefs.
Right. So to show, the contrast between, here are the values in critical thinking and skepticism. And here are the pitfalls of falling into, cognitive errors.
Mm-hmm.
And doing this through entertainment, through a story, as a way to sort of a sneaky approach, I guess, because, it is entertainment. So, it's supposed to be fun to read, and entertaining. And perhaps you won't notice, the messages.
Yeah. But those sometimes are the most powerful ones of all, right? The ones you don't necessarily notice. You're not being hit over the head with.
Yeah, yeah. It's sort of subtle.
The shields don't come up.
And just storytelling as a way to, I love lectures. I love documentaries, that give you facts, that teach you. But storytelling really has that ability to make the emotional argument rather than the intellectual argument.
Right.
It's sort of like, almost like an advertising, right? You can say what your product does and how much better, it is, the specs, or you can sell, the image of it,
the lifestyle.
Yeah. Yeah, we just talked about this just a couple
of
weeks
branding,
ago.
The branding.
Yeah.
The branding, yeah.
So, and then, you can form the emotional connection to some of the, basic concepts that are in science and secular humanism. So,
yeah.
I think that's either addition to science education or a way to draw people in to that.
Well, you also think about, people need and want to be entertained. And you might as well, use that as an opportunity to tell a good story. And I think, good stories are going to reflect a certain worldview, right?
Yeah.
And I think, the rationalist worldview is a fine one. you know, to be reflected in fiction, because otherwise we end up with the same tired old stories from Hollywood or whatever.
Exactly.
Over and over again. They have like the same three or four themes they keep hitting.
Yeah.
Oh, man wasn't meant to do this. It's not natural. Whatever. As we sort of
technology
one
versus nature thing. I remember seeing Avatar and was like, this would be so much better if the natives of the planet appreciated their nature because they had like a scientific understanding of it. And then the humans were after this metal because they were superstitious about it. Like they just, you know, they made trinkets out of it or something. Like to me, that would make more sense, you know, to go all the way there than to try to figure out, you know, you get into the nerd rant about the economics of the fictional story of going to Pandora and all that. It would just be users say, well, they think they're magic rocks. So that's why they go all the way there for them.
Yeah. Or you just, there would be, reality would be so much more complicated. I mean, you know, a lot of criticism that the Avatar movie got, again, the James Cameron movie about, it's kind of hard to discuss it if you haven't seen the movie, but essentially futuristic movie with, humans, essentially military operation going to a moon to mine unobtainium, which you joked about before.
Unobtainium.
And they have to essentially bowl over the natives. And then in order to get at their material, the unobtainium, they made it sound like it powers their infrastructure or whatever. It's actually an energy source for them.
For the natives, you mean?
For the humans. That's why they wanted to mine it. The natives didn't even know it was there. It was underneath their tree. We tend to, you know, have this idyllic image of native people that they were living completely one within harmony of nature. And, you know, the history doesn't really bear that out. It's always more complicated. You know, human beings have the capacity to really understand a lot about their environment, to certainly know how to live with it. But also we tend to be very destructive to our environment as well. That includes a lot of native peoples as well. They weren't necessarily, you know, living in this Disney World fantasy, you know, oneness with nature. But that's the narrative that we tell now, right? That's why I think the funniest commentary I've heard about Avatar was that the movie was essentially Dances with Smurfs, right? Because it was Dances with Wolves, but with blue people instead of Native Americans, you know?
Yeah, we got it.
You got it? Okay. I didn't have to explain it. Well, people might not know who Smurfs are. They're just about to reboot that franchise, right?
But yeah, isn't it,
we missed a generation, right? Did you ever watch the Smurfs?
Oh, yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
No, you made it.
There's only one girl in that population. How the heck is that? I mean, talk about it working against you as far as like evolution is concerned.
She'd be very popular.
Yeah, right? Very popular.
So you're trying to use your manga in order to have essentially a skeptical theme and not hit the reader over the head with it, but it's just the heroes are critical thinkers.
Right.
And that's okay.
You know, any good storytelling makes you feel connected to the characters. And, you know, if you can feel connected to a skeptical person, then I think that's a good thing.
Yeah. No, absolutely. You know, in your talk at TAM, you brought up the fact that, you know, there are some fiction for kids out there is more, gives a better message than others, like, and essentially expressed the same opinion that I had that, like, Harry Potter series, it's actually despite the fact that it's about magics, you know, in a school for magic, ironically, it actually is a very critical thinking message that they give, right?
Yeah, the magic, the school of witchcraft and wizardry is sort of just the equivalent to eye candy. You know, like, it's fun. That's the entertaining part.
Yeah.
But the characters themselves, they're problem solvers, they're critical thinkers. I mean, Hermione's always headed to the library, you know, to do research. The first book and movie are basically like a lesson on not trusting your intuition and you're having a bias, about, people or things. Questioning authority and, you know, like, it is. It's very skeptical and I think often quite even sort of secular humanist in its themes. And I think, you know, I think there's no reason why you can, I mean, science fiction is usually, you know, that's the critical thinking genre.
Yeah.
I mean, that it does, I mean, it's awesome at doing that, but I don't think there's any reason why you can't use fantasy or any other genre to not everyone likes sci-fi, unfortunately, yeah. You know?
Really?
There are people who should. Don't watch Star Trek. It's amazing.
Oh, okay. Now cut the crap.
Don't get crazy.
Oh, that crap. What foreign world is that you're talking about?
So you had to draw people in through, Harry Potter. So successful.
I wish there were a way to measure if a movie like Harry Potter actually does have a positive effect on the younger audience and what they do or what they've learned from that movie or from similar things to it. You know, it's hard to tell. Like, you know, is the message actually being successfully given? You know, how well is it being
understood?
There's
so many variables, it's hard to isolate that and say what effect it's really having.
I would argue, and I'm not disagreeing with you, Sarah. I'm thinking more along the terms, though, of I'd like to see a hero like the Sherlock Holmes movies. Real critical thinking. And make it cool and powerful and, you know, romantic and even a little dangerous, you know. We're all talking about authors using maybe, you know, some of these themes of science and critical thinking.
I agree, but since you bring up Sherlock Holmes, I love Sherlock Holmes, one of my favorite fictional characters. But the one thing I think that you, with that kind of fiction, this is also the case with like House, which is really a Sherlock Holmes character, is that making the deductive process, the reasoning process that Holmes go through, if it becomes a little bit too good, too inaccessible, then it seems like magic, right?
Right. Like in his reboot, the recent Sherlock Holmes reboot movies. I mean, he was actually at one point. They show him in a fist fight, and he was like doing things that no human can do, where he was like actually kind of experiencing it like Spider-Man would experience it. Like he was like mapping out every move that he was going to do in a nanosecond in his head, and almost as if he was forecasting it in slow motion, and then it played itself out exactly.
Well,
that's
cool. Fantastic.
That was a cool scene, though. I liked it.
It is cool, but yeah. I agree. I guess what I really don't like about that is teaching kids that intelligence is some magical talent you're born with, not something that anyone can develop by working on it. Mm-hmm. That's also why I don't like Jimmy Neutron, the cartoon Jimmy Neutron, which is...
Oh, are you dissing Jimmy?
Dissing Jimmy. I mean, I actually, it's one of the cartoons my daughters watch, and it's okay to watch. But I don't like the fact that Jimmy Neutron is... His intelligence is completely inaccessible to the audience. Mm-hmm. He figures out problems. He has a quote-unquote brain blast.
Yeah.
It's just this, inaccessible. You don't go through the process of how he actually figured it out.
That's
it's
a
just,
good point.
He magically makes the connection in his head because he's such a freakish, a freakish genius.
With what? An immense head that they always make fun of in every episode.
Yeah.
That's actually a good point.
Breaking it down and saying it's actually not that hard. Where sometimes, like in Holmes, at the end of the day, he does explain it to Watson.
Right.
And you do feel like an idiot for not seeing it yourself. And it does make it, you can make it seem like something you could have figured out yourself if you had, you know, applied it. If you were observant and you thought through all of the pieces. Actually, Holmes, the storytelling often does get it right. Again, not some of the adaptations of it. I do emphasize more the freakish talent rather than the hard work. And also, you know, in Holmes, this gets back to like the Hermione example. I love it. Hermione is one of my favorite fictional characters too, because I love the fact that she is successful because she's smart and she works hard. She's not a freakish smart. She's just like an ordinary sort of bright girl. Who is what she is because she works at it hard. And Holmes, Arthur Conan Doyle, although he was a character in and of himself, he made it very clear, right, in the Holmes series, that Holmes spent a lot of time studying, reading, gathering data. He was able to figure things out because he studied it in tremendous detail.
But getting back to what I was saying about Sarah and more about the kind of heroes that I like to see in movies and things like, and I think I have a strong feeling about this because when I was a kid, like I actually remember us playing Star Trek when we were kids, and you know our dad would videotape us teleporting. You know he would stop the camera and we would do all sorts of things, but we were actually into Spock and his process and the logic, and I remember that having an impact on us. Like we used to talk about it. It was cool that way, and everything seemed to be. You know, even what Captain Kirk did, it seemed to come from the hard work, and you know, there wasn't anything magical about it.
The Star Trek culture values excellence.
Yeah,
that came across in every character, right? In the whole culture was a culture that valued excellence, and so this validates what you're saying, in my opinion. This is anecdotal, but it does in that I think we picked up on that. We picked up on the fact that working hard and succeeding in that way was a virtue, right? That excellence was a virtue. And that was not anything that you got hit over the head with. It was just always there in the background, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I grew up watching The Next Generation.
Mm-hmm. That's adequate.
I'm also a Star Wars fan, but if you see the difference between, like, the messages, like, you have in Star Trek, you know, you have that, you know, pride in excellence and the teamwork, right? The Enterprise, you know, even though you have the captain, they're a team that, you know, everyone is needed. And people, you know, like Captain Kirk, Captain Picard, they earned their title as captain through hard work. And where in Star Wars, right, you have Jedi, well, you're born a Jedi. Luke's born a Jedi. And
well, he had to work hard to get there, but I don't even want to go here. He was born with the midichlorians. What a jackass. It
still drives me crazy. Oh, man.
Short drive. And you even have, right, he's in a lone ship, right? Yeah. There's no teamwork. There's the divine son, you know, with the royal blood, and he's the savior type thing. And, I mean, I love Star Wars. It's great, you know, and it's, you know, got that romantic, you know, thing going on.
It's a classic. It's an old story retold.
You wouldn't want our society to be run like that, though.
Of course. Right.
Well, no.
Yeah, I mean, to the heavy-hitting, snobby skeptics that we are, like, it's not 100% to our liking. Whatever, you know, movies and all that, they're not made for critical thinking. You know, nobody knows it better than us, I'm sure. But the idea, though, is that we want kids to pick up the idea that critical thinking and logic and being able to develop yourself is accessible. Like Steve said, that's a great point that Steve brought up. I hadn't even really considered that before. But I also want them to have heroes that inspire them, you know?
Yeah. I think the key thing that I would like to see is sort of merging the two together, right? Like you have the characters like in Star Wars, they're very charming, right? They're very human. You know, like everyday kind of people, right? Like Han Solo. Where I think to people who aren't hardcore Star Trek fans, like they know Spock, right? And he's like no emotions, right? Mm-hmm. Like it's that whole, you know, stereotype of like if you're smart or if you're a critical thinker, you know, then you don't have that emotion, like you're cold logic. And what I'd like to do is merge the two, right? You have characters that they're human, you know, and they're, you like them and they're warm and, you know, you have that emotional connection to them. They feel like real people, but they're skeptical and, you know.
Kind of like the SGU.
Exactly.
Yeah, here we go. Yeah.
Oh boy, you had to go there.
Well, you know, what the hell? That's what we go
there,
for.
We are there.
I mean, it's, you know, that's the, yes, of course, I'm a little self-congratulatory, but that is, we deliberately go for that vibe. So you're going for that same vibe in the characters of your manga series.
Exactly,
series, right?
Yeah.
You have good taste.
Sarah, if I wanted to go to your website, where would I go?
You can go to sarahmayhew.com.
How do you spell your last name?
Sarah with no H, and then Mayhew. There you can find...
Like if you had an axe, you may hew the wood.
Yes.
That kind of, yeah.
Okay. She's never heard that one before.
I bet she hasn't. Mm-hmm. Well, come
May
on.
You, may I what?
Wow, I was too tired to think of that. Oh, thanks, Sarah.
There you can find Secrets of Sorcerers, which was my first independently published book. You can get that on Amazon. You can find my blog, which is called There Are Four Lights for Star Trek.
That's one of my favorite bits.
Ooh.
I love that.
How many lights do you see?
There are four lights! I love that.
That's rocks. Yeah, that's where I put all my nerdy ramblings and skeptical things.
It has a 1984 quality to it. That episode, too. Which is, you know, fascinatingly disturbing. In
And then, of course, Legend of the Star. That'll link you to Legend of the Star, which is available. It's available on pretty much all the major ebook retailers for Kindle, for the iPad.
My daughter is enjoying it. Thank you.
Awesome.
Is that going to be an ongoing series? I mean, is that open-ended where you can just keep putting out sequels?
It will have an ending, but it's fairly big. It's fairly big.
Okay, so not for a while.
Not for a while, yeah. Okay. You can also read it online on the official website for free. And there's a nice little donate button if you really like it.
Right.
We all need support.
Pay as you exit. That's our method, right?
Little
give it away for free, and you know, if you like it, pay as you exit.
Pay as you exit.
Yes.
Awesome.
Okay, well, thanks for this. There's actually a really fascinating discussion. I think, you know, we do need to perhaps pay a little bit more attention to the intersection between art and science. You know, I think the skeptical movement is getting more and more of that. But we do like to, because art has the power to move us emotionally. And we've said on this show many times, yes, we greatly respect reason and science, but we are human beings with emotions. And if you deny that, we're not Vulcans, right? The Vulcans are sort of this sort of ideal, but we're not Vulcans.
And Vulcans did have emotions.
They have to be...
Spock did, yeah.
They suppressed it. Yeah, it was not like it was something that wasn't part of them. It was still part of them,
right.
But hidden.
Yeah. But, you know, the point being is that we have to learn how to be critical thinkers as humans, as emotional humans.
Yeah.
And I think art helps us by giving us these kind of iconic stories and narratives and ways of understanding ourselves and our culture, right?
Yeah.
So we appreciate the work that you do.
Thank you.
Well, let's go on and finish the show with a very special episode of Science or Fiction.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week, Stephen Novella comes up with three science news items or facts, two genuine and one fictitious. However, this week, I'm going to do it.
For the first time.
Yeah, for first time ever. So it's an honor, and thank you for the opportunity to do so, Steve.
Your debut running Don't let it go science to your head. Fiction.
How do you say like, debut in
like
French?
Like Bob.
I challenge this panel of skeptics to sniff out the fake. And you at home can play along, too. Do your own sniffing.
Oh, boy.
Is everybody ready?
Ready.
Yep.
Okay. There is a theme with this week's science
or
fiction.
Oh, boy.
And this should help you, not hinder you. I chose three news items that were sent in by listeners during the course of 2011. And we're going to see how good your memory is as to which ones you actually read and delved into.
Sounds good.
Excellent. Item number one. A recent study has found that pregnant women exposed to magnetic fields may increase the baby's risk of developing asthma. Item number two. A top astronomer was recently quoted as having said, quote, "The genesis of life is as inevitable as the formation of atoms. Life exists on other planets, and we will find it within 20 years. Item three. A species of manatee thought to have been extinct has been caught on video off the coast of Alaska. Sarah?
Oh, no.
As guest rogue, as is tradition, you get to go first.
Oh, boy. A recent study has found that pregnant women exposed to magnetic fields may increase the baby's risk of developing asthma. I don't know about that one, because magnetic fields, magnets, how do they work? I don't know. But to me, I don't know. That seems kind of suspicious, because just I don't like the fact that people are blaming magnetic fields for doing bad things. That seems, I don't know, kind of going on to the woo side. Sort of like how people, you know, have been scared that Wi-Fi, you know, was making their kids sick and stuff like that. So, I don't know, that one seems maybe a little suspicious. The quote from the astronomer, the genesis of life is as inevitable as the formation of atoms. I don't see any reason why a top astronomer wouldn't say something like that. so that seems fine to me. And as far as finding a species of manatee thought to have been extinct caught on video, I mean, I know that, you know, that has happened before, so I don't know why it would be unusual in this case. So I think I'm going to go for the first one, the magnetic fields may increase a baby's risk of developing asthma. That's the only one I seem to have a problem with.
Okay. Bob? So let's see, magnetic fields, I agree with Sarah on this one. That one sounds a little sketchy. It's usually not on magnetic fields, but I don't like that one. But let's look at the other one, shall we? This is unusual. The second one, the astronomer quote, is unusual because it's a quote. I don't think we've ever had a quote as part of science or fiction. And of course, it seems completely reasonable that an astronomer would say something like that. Genesis of life is as inevitable as the formation of atoms. Well, maybe not quite as inevitable as atoms, but still somewhat inevitable. 20 years? Life exists another 20 years. I mean, even that is I think, a decent estimate, especially once we our imaging gets even better. We could discover the byproducts of biology on other on distant planets within 20 years. I think that's very possible. I'm just wondering how this could be wrong. What did he say about this that was so different? That one's suspicious. And the manatee one, I've got a problem with that as well, because you've got a manatee off the coast of Alaska. I mean, they're typically warm water. You know, they're all manatees, I believe, are down south. So, all right, granted, it's a new species, and maybe it's cold adapted, but so that's a little sketchy. And it's pretty damn big. You know, a big surface swimming manatee that's been extinct, how is that missed? You know, it's not like a coelacanth that's thousands of feet below the surface of the earth, the water that, you know, was thought to be extinct for millions of years. This is the, you know, how does this get missed? I wonder if the first one is just a ruse to get us to overlook this third one here. Caught on video. Yeah, I'm going to go with my gut and say that the manatee's fiction.
Okay, Steve?
I don't like any of these. Which means you did a good job, Evan.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. A good point. I had a problem with every damn one of them.
Magnetic fields causing asthma? I think that's BS. It doesn't mean that a study didn't find that, though. And there is, you know, these subgroups of people doing research looking for correlations between EM exposure, magnetic field exposure, and, you know, different things like asthma. So that's kind of like the perfect crappy one-off study that shows a spurious result. So I could definitely see that. I don't remember any of these either, which is good. You probably went back too far because I do read every email. But
you do?
I do, every single one. So I don't know. I have a problem with that result, but I could believe that a study showed it. I just wouldn't think that the study was terribly reliable. Second one, I think the first sentence sounds familiar, and I have no problem with it at all. I agree that the genesis of life is as inevitable as the formation of atoms. That I think that's a reasonable statement, and I think I've heard astronomers make that statement. Life exists on other planets, sure, and we will find it within 20 years. That's where it's totally dubious. We'll find it within 20 years. That's an irresponsible prediction to make. Who knows? We have no idea how long it's going to take for us to detect life. So,
how about 21 years?
I either have to believe that that's the fiction that Evan added that little bit at the end, or that some top astronomer made, you know, a irresponsible prediction.
And that never happens.
No, obviously that could happen, just like the first one. I don't agree with the result, but somebody could have done that study. I don't agree with that statement, but somebody could have said it. And I had the exact same reaction to the manatee one that Bob did. Hey, don't they live in like warmer waters, like off the coast of Florida? But it could be if it's a new species. But it's a huge animal. I mean, Bob, I'm still going through the exact same thing you were. How could you miss a manatee? I mean, they're huge, and they're mammals. So they got to come up to the surface. Not like they exist in the deep water. So I have major problems with all three of these.
I agree with your assessment on the third one.
I'm going to go with the manatee one because, again, I think that, yes, somebody could have done a bad study and somebody could have said something that I disagree with, but I don't remember the manatee one. A new large mammal, I think that would have been a big enough news item that I would have heard about it. So it's, you know, it's like, I know that that method of reasoning is not always valid. You know, things do slip past our notice, but I just think probabilistically that's most likely to be the fiction. So I'll say the manatee is fiction.
Okay. And that leaves Jay.
Well, yeah, on first blush with these three, I'm like, wow, all of these seem like broken to me in one way or another. The first one about the pregnant women having their children having a greater chance of asthma if they're exposed to magnetic fields, and you know, since when? And what would the magnetic fields be doing physiologically? It would have to be something out of the ordinary, if at all. Like, I'm sure that a strong enough magnetic field could do something wonky, sure. But, you know, your average magnetic field that we all come in contact with, I find that highly unlikely. The one about the top astronomer saying that we're going to find alien life within 20 years. Sure, some astronomer could say that. I've heard a lot of them speculate and you know, say things that I really don't agree with. And out of all the times that these astronomers go out and give talks and try to popularize astronomy, that, you know, maybe some guy said some stupid thing at some point. You know, I don't think that it's that unlikely that somebody said something like this. So that one I can buy. And then the last one about the manatee, Steve brought up a good point. I mean, a mammal, in warm water that we hadn't noticed before. I mean, that just seems really unlikely. I could, you know, maybe they found a different kind of manatee, but I don't think they found it in Alaska, and I don't think that it is what Evan is saying here. So that one is the fake.
Okay. So therefore, you are all in agreement. Except for Sarah.
We have agreed to.
So the three gentlemen are saying the manatee is the fake, and Sarah is saying the magnetic fields increasing baby risk of developing asthma is the fake. Therefore, we're going to take item number two first. A top astronomer was recently quoted as having said, "The genesis of life is as inevitable as the formation of atoms. Life exists on other planets, and we will find it within 20 years. And this one is... science.
Oh, yay.
Did a good job. I actually pulled this pretty much straight from the headline of the article that was sent in. Oh, and by the way, this was sent to us by listener Alan Dunbar back on June 28th. And the article from which it came, from The Guardian, was put out on June 27th. The only word I omitted from that is a top Russian astronomer. Has said this, feeling that if I had left the term Russian astronomer in there, that perhaps that would have been a little bit of a giveaway.
You think we're bigoted against Russian astronomers?
I don't think it's so much that. It's that
more of an air of authenticity.
Well, I think so. I mean, because, you know, we hear some really crazy stuff in the news sometimes being quoted from astronomers like from all over the world and stuff. I mean, the United States is not necessarily an exception to that. I just felt taking out that little unique piece of information would make this a little more cloudy.
Maybe.
But y'all did a good job appearing.
Who was it?
And he did say it, Andrei Finkelstein, director of Russian Academy of Sciences Applied Astronomy Institute.
So what's the matter with this guy?
He was speaking at an international forum dedicated to the search for extraterrestrial life, and he said 10% of the known planets circling suns in the galaxy resemble Earth. Where he got that information, this article does not elaborate on. But he also says if water can be found there, so can life, adding that aliens would most likely resemble humans with two arms, two legs, and a head. So if you delve into this a little bit more, you know, it's kind of a lot of these points we've talked about before. What would an alien species exactly look like? And we've come up with lots of different ideas. I mean, yeah, it's possible it might have, you know, head, two arms, and legs, and a head, but it could also be a million or billions of other different things as well. So it's a little presumptuous, I think, to say that it would likely resemble humans.
Yeah, so we went way beyond just saying in 20 years.
He did. And this appeared in the Journal of Cosmology, actually.
Oh, isn't that wonky journal, that crappy one that,
ooh, it
that
sounds
published
like it.
That terrible life from meteors story recently? Yeah, I think so.
Yep. All right. So let's move on, and we're going to just choose randomly and go to the first one. A recent study has found that pregnant women exposed to magnetic fields may increase the baby's risk of developing asthma. Sarah, you believe this is the fiction. The guys think this one is science, and this one is science.
But thank you for playing, Sarah.
it's tough going first.
We have
first
lovely
in this
parting
game.
Gifts for you.
I almost went with that one.
This is the other
Me
one.
Me too.
Right? Yep. I thought this was the one that would get most of you.
I was going to go with that one until I talked myself out of it when I was thinking about the third one. I was definitely going to pick it.
When I play along at home, I always take advantage of the hindsight is 2020 bias and convince myself that, the other one was really what I thought.
Exactly. Ooh, I almost picked the right one.
That's a handy tool, that 2020 hindsight thing. So
I like saying hindsight's 2010.
This was a press release back on August 1st of this year, and listener Tamar Wilner from Dallas, Texas sent this to our attention. Thank you, Tamar, for sending this in. Press release from Kaiser Permanente. Study finds exposure to magnetic fields in pregnancy increases asthma risk. Women with high exposure to magnetic fields during pregnancy may have a higher risk of asthma in their children, according to this study. In the prospective study, researchers compared the daily magnetic field exposure of 801 pregnant women in Kaiser Permanente, Northern California, and used electronic medical records to follow their children for 13 years to see which children developed asthma. The study found that women with high magnetic field exposure in pregnancy had a more than threefold risk of asthma in their offspring compared to mothers whose exposure level was low.
But, you know, just forget about the science fiction angle, just thinking about what this study, how to interpret it. It's one study. It's not an interventional study. It's an observational study. So that means there's potentially lots of confounding variables that weren't controlled for. And I'm not sure what the plausibility is there in terms of cause and effect, you know.
But this all means that a species of manatee thought to have been extinct, has been caught on video off the coast of Alaska, is fiction.
Mm.
It was not a manatee. Would anyone care to take a guess? What was filmed recently off the coast of Alaska?
A mermaid.
A womanatee?
A Loch Ness monster-like beast.
Really?
No.
Yep. It's appearing on MSNBC.com back in July of this year, July 18th. And this one was sent in to us by listener Jeremy Buffington. Thank you, Jeremy.
Buffington.
Loch Ness monster-like beast filmed in Alaska. And there's a real awful picture of something that could be anything.
It could be a log.
It could be.
Floating log.
Sea otters.
When you see this picture, you're going to be like, that's like a hair on a desk or something. You can't even tell what it is. It's so ridiculous. All right. So that means we have three winners this week. The gentleman. Well done, guys.
Thanks, Evan. Good job. Actually, that was, I had to think about every one. That was good.
Yeah. Decent job, man.
Well, Sarah, it was wonderful having you on the show. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me. It was great.
It was a lot of fun. We also had a lot of fun hanging out with you at Dragon Con.
Yeah, it was awesome. I had a blast.
Just a quick reminder that the SGU24 live audio video streaming episode is next week, beginning September 23rd at 8 p.m. and running for 24 hours straight. We are looking for a lot of audience participation, so you can tweet us before and during the show by using the hashtag SGU24. That's the number 24. Also, check out the forum. Send us an email. We're looking for suggestions, and we'll be taking live questions and audience participation during the show. And thanks for joining me, guys.
Our pleasure.
Doctor,
thank you, Steve.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. You can also check out our other podcast, the SGU 5x5, as well as find links to our blogs and the SGU forums. For questions, suggestions and other feedback, please use the Contact Us form on the website. Or send an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. If you enjoyed this episode, then please help us spread the word by leaving us a review on iTunes, Zoom, or your portal of choice.